Coming up on today's BMW Motorrad Ride and Talk podcast, sitting down with Edgar Heinrich, head of design at BMW Motorrad. Take a listen. Over the years, I've had the privilege of riding BMW motorcycles all over the world. And the one thing I've come away with is that the only thing more extraordinary than the ride are the people you meet along the way. These are their stories. My name is Sean Thomas, and this is BMW Motorrad's Ride and Talk.
Yeah, and when I joined, in that was like 87, I think, there were three designers. And design was a bit different and quite a lot different from what it was now. Basically, it was pretty much engineering ruled. But slowly, things came. I mean, the company understood that it had to transform also. Yeah.
Looking back at the last 30 years, it's hard to think of anyone who has had a larger influence on what we see as BMW Motorrad than Edgar Heinrich. A designer with a vision, Edgar has brought to us the modern look and feel of several iconic BMW motorcycle models. During our interview, I was stricken with Edgar's knowledge and passion, but most of all, the humility of a man who began with a simple love of design and motorcycles and shaped this into what has become a legacy of tenacity, perseverance, and success. So there's something I saw the other day. I was watching the video of BMW and Marshall amplifiers and the collaboration that they're doing for their R18. And I saw something I didn't know about you, which is that you play the bass guitar.
Don't remind me on this one. That was really embarrassing because I hadn't touched a bass guitar. Literally, this is no joke. I didn't practice. They didn't tell me. I didn't touch a bass guitar for 10, 12 years.
Wow.
Because I used to play in a band for very long, for like 20 years or something. Yeah. And when I went to India, I quit the band, obviously.
Yeah.
And so I didn't play anymore. And when coming back to meet the Marshall guys, Adam, handed me the bass guitar and they do something. It was so embarrassing. At least I should have practiced before. You know,
at least they captured it on camera for all eternity. That's good.
I don't want to talk about it.
Well, I played drums for about as long as you played bass, and I probably haven't played the drums for as long as you haven't played the bass. And I was watching that going, if I was in that room and they made me play, I would be terrible.
Yeah.
It is a practice that must be.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
I mean, after a while you get in, but if you're completely fresh and haven't touched a guitar for 12 years, it's poor.
Yeah, that's rough. Yeah. Creativity, you know, playing music, of course, is something that we do to express creativity. But reading about you, even from a very young age, you were always doodling and drawing. I think you mentioned once that your mom has like books and books full of drawings that you did. How did that all get started for you?
I mean, somehow it came quite naturally, obviously, you know. I always was doodling. I mean, when I was a kid, you know, we started with these cards with cars on and bikes on and, you know, these quartets, we called it. And I did it myself when I was a kid. You know, I made my own cards and I drew these cars with like 600 horsepower and like acceleration like this and high top speed like that. Yeah, as a young boy would do, you know.
Yeah.
You draw your own dreams. And this always went on. And when I was in school, the subject changes. You do something to whatever, to impress the chicks or to cool stuff or whatever.
Yeah.
And at some point you found out that you had to do some work for school, for the teachers. Yeah. And sometimes instead of doing some writing work, I drew some scenery for the theaters, for example.
Yeah.
And that was much easier for me to do these drawings than instead of making a big writing.
Hmm.
So you find out it's quite comfortable. If it's easy for you to draw and express with drawing, you find out that it's an easy way to get along with.
Yeah.
And this is how it came.
And around the same time too, when you were a kid, you had motorcycles in your life. Yeah. You mentioned that you guys used to take old bikes and go running them around the backcountry.
I mean, I had two elder brothers and they had friends, obviously, with bikes.
Yeah.
We grew up in the countryside in a village in Bavaria, you know.
Yeah.
And for us, it was totally normal to ride around, to roam around in the countryside on motorbikes or on old cars. And I think this is something, if you look at it in retrospective, for us young guys on the countryside, growing up in the countryside, nowadays it sounds so ridiculous somehow, so boring. But for us, this was real freedom, you know, because we were locked in the village.
Yeah.
I mean, we had one car in the family and the dad took it to go to work. Mm. So you were locked there. Either you go on the bicycle, but then it didn't go so far, or you had one of these escape vehicles.
Yeah.
And we always had this. We tinkered around. It came quite naturally. Mm. We inherited an old car from my auntie, you know, a small Fiat 600. And we made a convertible out of it. And we took double tires on the back so we could roam the fields. And we made a cool exhaust pipe, you know, all these stupid things. But this is how I grew up. And always things broke down and you had to repair it. You couldn't afford a craftsman or something.
Yeah.
So we did it by ourselves. And so you learn by doing.
Now, even today, you have mentioned that you like to spend time in your garage repairing, restoring motorcycles. Do you feel that has just come as a natural extension from your childhood and sort of being forced to work on bikes to keep them running so you could explore?
I'm quite sure about this. I think when you grow up like this, what I just explained, it's very natural.
Yeah,
it's not only about bikes. When I was young, along with my brother and also my dad, we tried to fix everything. I mean, it might be the washing machine or the iron of mom's iron or the whatever it was, or repairing some tiles or building a garage or doing everything, you know. And this is how I and we grew up in those days, in the 70s, 80s. And this is why I like to talk about semantics and mechanics. Mechanics is something you can see and you can feel by the gut somehow. You have this alligator brain.
Yeah.
You see something like which works with levers and hinges and this kind of stuff and wires. And you look at it and you see it.
Yeah.
And you see if something is broken. Mm. This is different with electronics, obviously.
Sure.
iPhone is something very different. I can't do anything with it. But these mechanical things and the semantics are always around us. And this is what I understand. You slowly grow into it.
Yeah.
And bikes is kind of the same thing. You see a bike is basically built from mechanical things.
Mm.
I just love to do this, and I just, it's somehow very natural, and I like to do it. And if I can't do it for some while, I start missing it.
Yeah. Take me back to design. You're doodling a lot going through school. You're finding that you're a very visual person and like to create drawings. And how did this ultimately translate to making the decision to get a formal education in design?
I think I was not the best student or so to say. I was not so massively dedicated. you always try to find a workaround somehow. But then when I finished high school, you have to make a decision to do something.
Hmm.
And I didn't really plan a lot for this.
Yeah.
So it came quite natural. I went to a town where my brother had a flat because he was in university there. Yeah. And they had a course for architecture. And I thought that could be something for me because architecture is quite nice and you can draw and a little bit technology is also involved. And I thought that could be something for me. So I went to Rosenheim and started my architecture university, which was quite okay. But then I know there is these points in life that changes direction and not really planned for it.
Mm.
But there was I remember we had this lesson. We stood in the field and we had to draw a farmhouse, you know, with trees and all these cows and stuff and buildings. And at this point, my professor came up to me and he said, "No, what are you actually doing here? And I think you should not be here."
What?
That was pretty strange. I mean, this is something that is a bit shaking in the first moment.
Yeah.
Because I didn't think, what does it mean? I mean, is my drawing so bad or what is it? Mm. And I talked to him in the evening then, and he advised me maybe I should try something else, use my talents and stuff. Okay, so what I did is I finished my lesson, I finished my year, and then I looked around in Munich and checked out all the different schools which were there. And this is how I encountered design, industrial design. I didn't know about this before. Mm. And there was this school in Munich, and you see all these drawings of people, and they draw some devices or household goods or whatsoever, machines. And then they did models out of it. Mm. And that was something I thought, man, this could be something for me, because tinkering was always my thing and drawing was my thing.
Yeah.
So I thought, this could be something for me.
Yeah, sure.
So I made my entrance, test. You had to do drawings and stuff for 2 days. And I passed it. And so this is how I came to industrial design.
Wow.
Yeah, that was the beginning, basically, of my professional career.
Yeah. Recently, I had a chance to sit down with design students from a design school in California, in Petaluma, and they were designing the future of motorcycles. What was fascinating to me is these students were drawing out motorcycles, but it was really clear that they didn't really understand mechanically how a motorcycle functions. They were giving us the design and putting the pieces in their traditional places. You know, the tires were in where you'd expect them to be, in the wheels and the handlebars and the seat. But beyond that, they were these really wild outcroppings that if you have any mechanical mind, you'd probably think, I don't think that this can really exist in the real world, but it is cool. It makes me wonder, do you find that to be the case today? Is there a designer and an engineer and the two are not the same? Or is it pretty common to have people that understand mechanics of a motorcycle as well as design?
Good question. On the one hand, probably I'm a little bit of a dinosaur because I come actually from a world what I just described, which is pretty much addicted by mobility. Mm. I mean, I love these bikes and cars and all this kind of stuff. Not necessarily combustion engines, also electric whatsoever, but the mobility itself, I think this is something, it's very much inherent. It's kind of very, it's something which comes very deep to mankind. Mobility is quite important.
Yeah.
And where I come from, this how it grew up into mobility somehow. And this is my style. I think mechanics is always a part of the whole thing, but not on everything. And for me, it's kind of connected. And in this company, I think it's also comes very natural, because most of these people, or almost everybody in this motorbike company, is a motorbike freak in one or the other way. Some are off-road guys and some are restoring and some are racers and whatsoever. But they're all kind of driven by the love for bikes and by the passion and the emotion which is inherent there. That does not necessarily say, and we also encounter this very often, that we get applications or from students or from people. I look at these drawings and I think, wow, this guy has no clue about motorbike.
Yeah.
But I also learned that this is not necessarily so important, because very often it brings you off onto new ideas or how to reevaluate given facts can be very useful and or valuable.
I imagine that has to be important now as we start to progress into electric motorcycles, and some of the traditional placements of parts on bikes are no longer necessary where they are. So it must be nice to have somebody that doesn't look at it conventionally and say, oh yeah, I guess we could put what used to be the fuel tank can go away and we can put something there we never thought of.
That's exactly the point what I want to say. If you look at electric mobility now, the cars are very new. Hmm. I mean, it's like a white sheet of paper.
Yeah.
If you look at the, this is my comparison, if you look at the 20s or 30s from the 20th century, when the combustion engine motorbikes were developed from the 1920s, 1930s. If you look at these bikes, there is numerous ideas or ways to make suspension or to make braking devices or make ignition devices or how to have an engine connected to a gearbox. There is very different ways. And this is super interesting if you look at these bikes. Nowadays, this is all lost. Nobody knows it. Yeah. If you go in a museum, it's super inspiring. And exactly this we find in electromobility now. We think a fork has to look like a fork because all the forks look like that.
Yeah.
But that's not the case. I mean, you can really explore now again.
Yeah.
Not the fork maybe, but the engine setup, the battery setup, the whatever, how to rearrange all the different components on a bike.
We can see this, I think, on components now that we don't think of as being that strange, but at the time when they came out, they were very strange. I mean, I just look at a swing arm, a single swing arm rear suspension on a bike, which now most of the bikes that I ride have that, but there had to be a time when that first came out and people said, there's no way that can hold up. There's no way that that bike is going to be durable with this thing.
Yeah, definitely. Very often, I mean, if you look at this IMME from whatever, 1940 or something, I don't know exactly when it was, it had like one tube in the front and one in the rear.
Yeah.
It looked totally strange. It looks strange when you look at it now.
Yeah.
But it worked. And now we have all these mono levers and they work perfectly.
Yeah. And we also certainly have to take into consideration is like, what can the consumer expect to accept as a leap in design? Yeah. Because even if functionality is there, if it's too out of whack, is it going to be accepted by the public?
I think it depends a lot because you have very different kind of customers. I mean, you have these sophisticated, innovative guys, and then you have these conservative guys, and then you have everything in between the middle.
Yeah.
And it's definitely not easy for us as a manufacturer, which has a very wide portfolio. I mean, we have from an R18, from very, how do you say, traditional bikes to super modern bikes like an electric scooter and race bikes in between and touring bikes in between and off-road bikes in between. We have a very wide portfolio and very different multiple customers, obviously. And to satisfy all their needs, there is a certain strategy behind it. I think we're doing pretty okay, pretty good. It seems to work out quite good. But it's right. You have to adjust to the customer needs, obviously.
So you finish your tenure through industrial design and somewhere along the line, you join BMW. Did you start straight with motorcycles?
Yeah, when I did my thesis work in this school, what you mentioned before, it was very clear that I want to build a motorbike.
Yeah.
I want to design a motorbike. And my idea was very naive somehow from nowadays looking back. My idea was I build a one-to-one motorbike because this is much more impressive than all these small little one-to-four model scale models. Mm. I mean, guys did it before, but one-to-four scale model looks a bit like a toy. You know?
Mm.
And I wanted to have a one-to-one motorbike. I wanted to sit on it and the spring had to work. Mm. That was my target. And I thought, again, very naive, I asked some of these manufacturers, they should support me with either money or parts.
Yeah.
Then it's less work, you know.
Sure.
And the only company which came back to me was BMW, which was not so cool because BMW was not very cool in those days. I rode Suzukis in those days. So I had to work with BMW, which was a pity because, and then the way out was, man, I do a BMW for young guys, you know, because these BMWs in the 80s, they look pretty much for old men. Not very cool.
And this was a critical time too, because the 80s we had what is now the modern superbike, your sport bikes, you know, like the Suzuki Katana.
Yeah, exactly.
And GSXRs and CBRs and Honda Hurricanes. And what did BMW have? We had the...
Exactly. You know what
didn't have that.
They had. I mean, the K100 just came out, and then they had these old boxers. I mean, that was not really cool bikes, at least not for young guys. So the way out was to do a motorbike for young guys. So I welded me a frame back home in the garage and put all this foam on and plaster and stuff.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, it worked out that it was way much more work than a scale model then. But okay, anyway. But at least I could present it at BMW.
Yeah.
And obviously they were a little bit impressed or whatever. And they offered me a job. So, and I thought, man, I don't want to work at BMW, but probably I have to because I needed money.
And they're the only ones offering, huh?
Yeah, that was it, actually. This is how it worked out.
Yeah, and this is your home, too. You were still living in this area. And so coming here probably was an easy transition.
Yeah, it wasn't easy, but I think we changed quite a bit
in
the perception, yeah.
So when you came on here at first, most people that I've met that started at BMW started as an intern and worked their way up. But it sounds like you went straight into industrial design here, yeah?
Yeah, and when I joined, that was like 87, I think, there were three designers.
Wow.
That was pretty small, I mean. And design was a bit different or quite a lot different from it was now.
Yeah.
Basically, it was pretty much engineering ruled. That was the time in the 80s. I mean, BMW bikes, they were not very cool, but they were extremely reliable.
Yeah.
Every brand had its own USP, so to speak. Mm. I mean, Ducatis, the Italians, they look cool, but they didn't have electric.
Yeah.
And the British bikes, they were okay, but they leaked oil. Like, and Harleys, they lost screws. I mean, that was the typical thing in those days. Mm. And if you wanted to have a reliable bike, you go for a BMW. It doesn't look cool, but it's reliable.
Sure. And your goal was to make it look cool as well.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I needed a job. And and in those days, it was a bit... But slowly things came. I mean, the company understood that it had to transform also, because the other companies also transformed. Mm. I mean, you know this. I mean, the Harley is reliable now, and the Triumph doesn't leak oil anymore, and Italians have electronics now.
Yeah.
So BMW has to look cool also.
Yeah, sure. So from those days in the 80s when you started on, do you have any memorable first projects that you can share with us? What comes to mind for you?
Yeah, the first things what you start when you're a young designer. I mean, you do some accessories or you do a little facelift.
Sure.
First work was the facelift of the K100, the seat. I remember this one.
Okay.
It's quite, in retrospective, it's quite funny somehow. Yeah, I mean, you make like 30 drawings for a different handle of a passenger, of a pillion seat, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, as a young rookie, of course, you try to impress people. And this is somehow it worked out, I don't know.
Yeah.
And then the tasks, they grew up a bit.
Yeah.
And what was probably the first really big thing was the R1100 RS.
Yes.
Which was the four-valve boxer engine.
And the very first bike with a four-valve.
Yeah, it was the first bike with a four-valve, yeah. And that was, so to speak, interesting because for the company, it was a very important bike because this bike had to deliver the business turnover, basically. BMW was about to abolish the bike business because it was not so, it didn't work out money-wise. And this bike was the last attempt to make the business work with bikes.
You know, at the time, and even now, when I speak to purists, they consider the RS the purist's bike. It's the bike that if you love BMW, it gives you everything that you would want on the street. And that RS in particular started to signal to me a big change because the look of the bike, the design, it looked like it had a taut skin over a muscular animal. That's always what I thought of when I looked at that and the bikes that came after it, like the K1200 RS, for example, and the K1200S. They were always these designs are very almost organic in their look and feel. Was this part of your influence?
I don't know, probably, yeah, because I mean, I did the design of the R1100 RS, the first one.
Mm-hmm.
And if I look at it now, I'm not very, how to say, I'm not super proud on it. But it was at least my first attempt to change things a little bit.
Yeah.
And it was let's say it was for this reason, it was important because it gave me quite a bit of self-confidence.
Yeah.
Because they were, I just said it was an important bike for the company, and they hired like, I think it was 4 external designers to make their design, to put in their design.
Yeah.
But they were all canceled and they took my design.
Wow.
And I was the rookie in those days, so yeah. I was quite proud on this one that I made it. Yeah. I don't say the bike is super nice or super perfect or whatsoever, but at least it gave me a bit of confidence.
Yeah.
And so for the next steps, I really tried to push a bit more.
Yeah.
Bikes like the R1100S, for example, or specifically the K1200R, they were bikes who were not ordered like that.
Yeah.
But I just was a bit wanted to be a bit progressive, and I put this thing in the arena, and they picked it. Actually, that was quite, on the one hand, important for the company, because these really changed a little bit the perception of BMW design. Yeah. Let's say they were quite, especially the K1200R, that was quite outstanding. First of all, it was the strongest roadster in those days, and it had a pretty excessive and bold design statement. I remember that was pretty interesting, because the British magazine, the MCN, you know, they usually didn't take notice of BMW. That was really not so cool. But this bike was on the cover page.
Wow.
And the MCN, they said, BMW goes mad or something like that. And that was, for us, that was like, wow, we opened a bottle of wine or champagne, you know, for this headline. So was kind of feeling like, boy, now we made it.
It was an interesting transition too with the K1200R, because it seemed like the design of the bikes started to shift from that sort of organic skin on a machine look to a more angular, sharper look. You know, we saw bikes like the new RT come out, the facelifted 1200 GS at the time. It started to get sharper angles, more utilitarian look. Things that we start seeing carry on even to today, where we see some of those angles represented in things like the CE04. How does these design changes and how they affect the character of the model line decided? Where do you, is this something that you are thinking of well ahead of time, or is it something that just happens spontaneously?
It's probably a combination of both. On the one hand, what I feel, I realized this only very many years later, but when you're constantly working in workshops, working together with people who have the same mindset, and they're always talking about motorbikes and what could be and how we should do it, and they're always criticizing what you're doing. I mean, criticizing in a sense of, if you do something wrong, your friends will tell you in the evening in the workshop, hey, what did you do here? That's not good. Why didn't you do it this way?
Yeah.
Or why did you do this? And you are permanently, because we had to, because of whatever money or economics or whatsoever.
Yeah.
So you're constantly under stress, positive stress, let's put it this way, because you're permanently living in this culture, in this bike culture. So you're permanently alert of what is the latest stuff and what could be good and what could be interesting and what people like or dislike. So this is one thing. So this permanent, I miss the English word. You're permanently stressed by the environment, the bike environment. So this is one thing. And on the other hand, it's sometimes very spontaneous.
Yeah.
Because you see things and you think, we could do it this way. Why didn't we do it this way?
Yeah.
And then the third thing is probably also you're in what I call a parallel universe. You're always 4 or 5 years ahead of which is out there on the markets. Which is out there on the streets is totally old and old-fashioned for us.
Yeah.
Because we have always 4 or 5 years ahead of the existing bikes.
When I look back at some of the designs from the 90s to the 2000s, I wonder how much of the design had to be compromised just based on available technology. I mean, something as simple as the shape and style of a headlight on a bike. You know, are you able to have a wide breadth in which you can choose from in order to achieve the look you want? Or are you working with a manufacturer that says, these are the sizes and shapes we have available and you just have to make it work?
This is a subject which changed a lot. If you go back to the 80s, 90s, 2000s, it was a lot like this. You have to have your you have the components you have.
Yeah.
They are whatever available, or they are cheap, or make a business case. Then sometimes you have to work for it.
Yeah.
And if you develop new things, it's more costly. Obviously, it takes longer time. But there's also chances in it. If you look at the R1150 GS, you know, the facelift of the four valve boxer GS, it introduced this asymmetric headlight.
Right.
And this was a component which was available.
Yeah.
And there were not so many components available which would fit the package.
Right.
Because we had this squarish lamp, which I didn't like, and I wanted to have something else. So they gave us this component. You have to work with it.
Yeah.
And so we said, why not doing it? First, it fits the package. It's lighter than the previous one. It's more performing than the previous one. So this is why we get along with it.
Yeah.
And this is something I always say, I'm not afraid of asymmetric things, for example, if they are maybe either interesting looking or they are technically superior.
Yeah.
Which is very often the case. I mean, we have numerous examples for this.
Yeah, absolutely.
And at the end of the day, it made a very iconic feature out of BMW.
Yeah, it started out as something where I'm sure people scratch their heads and say, why are they doing this? And now you can trace things as simple as the asymmetric headlight to so many different models that BMW has presented since then.
I think you have to dare once in a while. You have to dare something which is a little bit awkward in the beginning, but it turns into something interesting. Maybe.
Yeah.
Not always mainstream is not always the best thing.
Yeah. What is the SAS tagline? He who dares wins. I believe. I think that applies differently to them. But if there was a model of motorcycle in your time here that you would hang your hat on and say this is the one I'm most proud of, could you name a bike?
Mm. It's difficult. Mm-hmm. Probably one of the bikes I really like is what we just mentioned, the K1200R. Mm. That was really a little bit of a game changer, I would say.
Yeah.
Also, what's also a game changer was the 1200 GS, the air cooled one, and then definitely the S1000RR. That was definitely something which, again, a game changer.
And that one in particular was such a game changer because that world was really well established. There were people making bikes that were the leaders in that segment, and nobody, including me, expected the RR to be able to seriously compete in that world. And yet it did. And now it's considered one of the top in that world. And that takes me back to when you first started here saying, I want to make a cool bike, you know, that young people can ride. And that's really what you got with that bike, isn't it? Because suddenly you have people going to the dealers that are 20 years younger than the average customer.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, like I said, we expanded our portfolio a lot, especially the double R.
Yeah.
That's definitely one bike which is for younger persons, for younger people. But also bikes like a CEO4, for example.
Yeah.
That's also new customer types. But all these bikes with a super emotional appearance, you know. Mm.
BMW put out an ad campaign for the RR, and they showed a designer designing what they wanted the front of the RR to look like. And they designed it, and they didn't like it, and they tore the page in half. And then they designed a new design, and they didn't like it, and they tore it in half. And then the head of design came in and saw two separate images put together side by side of two separate pictures of the bike, with asymmetrical headlights, and said, yep, that's a great idea. That's what we're going to do. How close to the truth is that really?
Absolutely not. I mean, the basic reason for this asymmetric headlight was, it was quite simple. When we did this bike, we checked multiple layouts in terms of frame and engine and all this thing, because we wanted to do our own thing and we didn't want to make the same layout like all the competitors did.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, we found out that the performance gap is so narrow in this area that you just have to basically get the same layout.
Mm-hmm.
But then it comes a lot to weight also.
Yeah.
The weight is very important because it pays in to performance. So we tried all these little chances we could find weight. And one of these chances was the headlight, because you have a high beam and a low beam, obviously.
Yeah.
Usually on both sides of the bike. And the high beam, you can make smaller and lighter if you reduce the size, because the technical thing is requirement is different from the high beam and the low beam.
Right.
So we reduced the size of the high beam in order to gain, I think it was 130 grams or something like that, if I'm right. And it was just, it just gave us an advantage in terms of weight. The same with these gills on the side, you know.
Yeah.
Because if a fan on one side and the other side, you don't have a fan.
Yeah.
So again, here, some grams here, some grams there. You end up with a asymmetric light. But okay, whatsoever. If it helps increasing the performance, we go for it.
Yeah. It has to be fascinating to get to see things that are happening on the car side here and all of the technology that they are pushing the limits with, and then look at those things and go, I might be able to incorporate that into these bikes. LED lights, for example, which for a long time just didn't exist anywhere. And now we're really seeing them incorporated.
Yeah. I mean, it's quite natural. You have new technology and you try to get the new technology in. Of course, it's lighter. It's it consumes less electricity.
Yeah.
So it's just a, how do you say, the normal way of evolution in technology.
I remember in 2004 model year, I think it was, the R1100S replica had carbon fiber valve cover protectors. And at the time, carbon fiber was cutting edge. Like nobody was using it. And BMW found a way to incorporate it. And then we saw it again, I think in 2008 with the HP2 Sport, the carbon fiber valve covers, again at a time when not only was carbon fiber not being used often, but it wasn't readily available because all of these manufacturers of airplanes were using it to lighten the load. And of course now carbon fiber is just a readily available thing that we see going. Is there other technologies that you see like at this moment are really cutting edge that have been recently incorporated into a production bike?
I think this is something which is constantly happening anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, in those days, the carbon fiber was extremely expensive. That's right. But then bikes like HP2 Sport, it was really super. I think it was $29,000 or something like those days. Now it's even more. But I mean, you can afford it in those bikes, obviously. Yeah. And we incorporate lots of stuff like in our high price bikes, like the M bikes, for example.
Yeah.
Of course, there is cutting edge technology.
Mm-hmm. You have a Mega Moto in your garage, do you still?
I have a HP Enduro.
Yeah.
The Mega Moto I recently had, but I sold it off to a friend because it was just standing there for years.
Now, there's people listening to this podcast right now that are raising their hand because they want me to ask you, can BMW make another HP2? Because that really was an amazing bike for its time.
Oh, this is the first time I hear this question.
Really?
Come on. I mean, everybody is constantly asking me, hey, what about this? How we do a HP2? And, it's a super interesting question. Especially, I mean, you have to say that is like some few thousand motorbike enthusiasts here.
Yeah.
And probably, I don't know, at least half or even more of half, they are GS freaks.
Yeah.
And sure. I know there's so many people who own HP2s here.
Yeah.
And the rest wants to have one.
Yeah. In the US, they're worth way more than they were new.
Yeah.
And they were not cheap new.
No, same here.
Yeah. They're hugely popular, and people say. But we also hear that about the K75. And there's another group of people going, can you bring back the K75?
Okay, I'm not so sure about the K75. So.
It had its day.
Yeah.
And they're still out there. So folks, if you want one, you can find one. It's a really good time sitting down and talking with you, Edgar. Thank you so much.
Most welcome. I'm not quite sure who is interested in this. Somebody will hear the end here.
Believe me, there's going to be a lot of people listening and very happy that you sat down with us. So thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Sean.
Rock on. We very much hope you have enjoyed this episode. We want to hear from you, so please rate, comment, and share your thoughts about this podcast. We have many more episodes on the way, so please subscribe, follow along, and share your requests for future episodes of the BMW Motorrad Ride and Talk podcast.